guess to some extent I'm the old man of the industry. Asian Banker is now 21 years old. And the funny thing about being called the Asian Banker is that we're no longer Asian and we're no longer banker. We have offices in Dubai, we do business in Nigeria, West Africa, South Africa. Whenever we hold an event, you will see people of many different communities, Arabs and Africans and Chinese and now Japanese in our community. And we're no longer banker because we also have started to cover the peer-to-peer industry and then building from there to a much broader broader industry. One of the things that you will excuse me is for the way in which I've evolved as a person, and I think that it will show in the presentation that I'm about to make. So, all of you will remember that Kim Jong-un, the leader, the respected leader of North Korea, gave this speech recently. He said that in the next 10 years, North Korea will be the first country to send a man to the sun. And when he made that announcement, he had an amazing applause. But the foreign media in North Korea just went on to the side and said, sun, isn't that a little bit difficult and too hot to get close to? And he said, we'll do it at night. But of course, not to be left behind, the great leader of the United States heard this, and at his big rally, post-election and post-presidential rally in Florida, he said, that's not possible, because there's no sun at night. There is no such thing as a customer-centric bank. A bank is an institution for profit. Its first motivation is profit, and it's its most important reason for existence. And in the rest of my presentation, as I go along, you will start to see the dichotomy between being what we imagine to be customer-centric and that big divorce, that big divide between banking and its customers, and why that divide will never be matched. Banking is also not employee-centric, if I were to bring it a little bit closer to you. Those of you who have seen your colleagues lose their jobs and have a security guard stand next to him and be handed a yellow slip. Everything that the HR says about being employee empowering and team building and building a franchise and so on suddenly disappears, because at the end of the day, the institution is a profit-making animal. And this is the profit-making animal that all of us spend our careers trying to make sense of and contribute to, and we think that we're making a meaningful change. There are three things that I want to be talking about today. I want to talk about fintech, I want to talk about APIs, and I want to talk about the conversation. I apologize to all of you who are in the fintech community who think that you are making a huge difference to society and to the industry. When I started Asian Banker in 1996, my goal, one of my goals, was to be the most connected person in the financial services industry in the next 10 years. Then 1997 came about, and many bankers lost their jobs. 1999, I had friends who had gone to jail, and I had friends who had given up the banking industry and gone on to do other things, teaching in universities and so on. And then that phenomenon just kept repeating itself every 3 to 5 years. And as I see all of you here in this audience, you've had massive changes in your careers in the last 20 years or so. In fact, one of the reasons Asian Banker has been able to grow into the Middle East and Africa is because we followed some of the key professionals who were moving into those regions, even as there was consolidation in this part of the world. So in my eyes, fintech is made up of three important dynamics: access people, access capital, and the liberalization of the technology itself to become more open. And one of the favorite phrases that IT vendors like to say when they make a presentation on a product is, "I used to be a banker." Almost as if it gives them the validity to substantiate a product that they're introducing for the short term. This slide on core banking systems is something that I copied from a very good friend of mine, Leslie Lowe. Some of you know him to be an entrepreneur who actually pioneered one of Singapore's original core banking systems. And you recognize the structure, which is in a core banking system, at the very baseline is the general ledger, and then from there the customer information file, the middleware layer, the data and analytics, and so on. And in the early years, we used to think of core banking in an enterprise sort of a format. And as the years went on, the IT vendors started to be able to deliver to the different levels or layers of the infrastructure. So what we call fintech today is a lot of different players providing on a Java platform what used to be an enterprise solution. And the most important dynamics that has changed in fintech is the pricing structure. And we, who run Asian Banker, and of course the organizers of this conference as well, who have got all the sponsors, we feel it. The IT companies that used to be able to spend lots of money with us because they were able to charge $2 million for a data analytics project with a bank, today have been disintermediated by smaller companies that are able to provide very targeted solutions at the CRM level. And quite recently, I was speaking to someone who's doing exactly that with one of the local banks, and he was trying to show me his technology, and I said, how are you building this? He says, "I've got $2 million in funding, and it's growing." And I said, "How much are you charging the bank for the project?" He said, $40,000. And in all likelihood, he will have just that one bank for that project. And if he's lucky, 3 or 4 banks around the region. And like him, there will be many different players who are disintermediating the fintech phenomenon in the industry that we serve. And as long as their customers are banks, you are in no danger of introducing innovation. You are in no danger of being creative. You are in no danger of disrupting the industry. Because as far as the banks are concerned, you're a different pricing proposition for something that they've been always doing. For the banks, it's a very interesting journey. What used to be an enterprise-level core banking infrastructure is being disintegrated but still carried into the new world. And there's no change in that regard. So even as the IT vendors are talking about moving onto the cloud, the way the banks map it is, if we had a core banking hardware on mainframe, we now do it on a server. If we had a dedicated operating system, today we have Linux, and so on. And so everything that we used to do just gets mapped into what we think the future will look like. When we think of APIs, it is a very promising infrastructure. But if we think about it in the way that we think of our traditional technology and carry it into the new world, then we lose the chance to make sense of it and benefit from it. So the evidence is that there are thousands of APIs out in the marketplace, and there are companies that make lots of money from APIs. In other words, it is a viable business proposition. And the discipline of the API industry is being built. In fact, you can sense it, because those of you who are already creating APIs, you know that you need to build chat groups, you need to have good documentation, you need to have practice runs, you need to have samples, and so on, and build a community. That part of building the API infrastructure is the easy part. The part that we forget as banks, because of the way we are structured and the way we think, is the part that builds that relationship with the industry that we want to serve. Let me personalize this to you. Being of the age of Rama and so on, okay, I mean, some of you have got kids. I have no kids, but I've got 5 god kids. 2 in Hong Kong, 1 in San Diego, 2 in San Diego, and 1 in Seattle, and I love them like crazy. When I go out into the parks with them, you know, they will look up and name the animals, and I have to, you know, look up on Wikipedia, because I'm not sure what they're talking about, and just to keep up with them. These two are my Hong Kong god kids. And quite recently, the younger one, Jeannie, was sitting next to me around Chinese New Year, and she was showing me her app on the phone. And her mother said she built this game app on her own. And this is Jeannie's game, age 11. She was using an API. This is Money 2020 last year in Vegas. And I was there, I was sitting in the audience. And on the back of 3 or 4 different APIs based on what the sponsors were giving them, I saw an enthusiastic crowd of people or participants in a hackathon building applications that made sense to them. So there was this couple that did something about paying street performers with a QR code, another couple building a Fitbit app on Alexa. But the interesting team is the one that actually won the top prize, which used that device called Alexa, which is a voice prompted data analytics tool, to build a sales mechanism, a sales check. It checks on how much sales you do in a day and so on. And they did a test of that where the device could tell them what was the sales last month, what the kind of things that they sold, who is this customers were coming to see them, and so on. But the most interesting thing that caught my attention was when they were accepting the prize, the girl in yellow said the person who did the programming was her sister at the back, age 14. And there are other kids, age 18, age 21, age 24, who are the ones that whose imagination you want to capture in order to give life to your APIs. Sorry? So I asked myself, what would little Jeannie, or that 14-year-old girl, let's call her Kate, or the 18-year-old kid called Muhammad, or a 21-year-old boy called Chongqiong, say if they looked at the ABS, MAS, API playbook? Remember what I said about how we've transposed our core banking infrastructure into the new world? They probably look at it and say, Uncle Mohanty, what is this data that you're putting up, MES data that you're putting up into the APIs? And he'll say, well, this is the stuff we have, you know. So what do we do with it? Whatever you want, up to your imagination. And if the kids ask Uncle Mohanty, what does your imagination tell you about what we can do with the data you're putting up there? Well, I hope that Uncle Mohanty is here to answer that question. They'll probably ask Auntie Aibun. Auntie Aibun, your APIs look suspiciously like problems that your banks wanted to solve 10 years ago, which they haven't solved yet. And they're just putting it up on the open space so that maybe somebody will solve it. There is such a great need to walk away from the world that we come from to the world in which we are entering today. These are the top finance APIs in the world right now, and it's taken from a website called Programmable. Most of them have to do with payments. Most of them have to do with things that are fronting the customer, the customer's experience, in the same way that I pointed out to you the Money 2020 competition, hackathon. One API, or the strongest API in this room that could be in that list, is Nets. But it's in the nature of shared infrastructure that its member banks will not allow it to. And there's nothing wrong there, by the way, okay? Because I see this repeated in every country. So the most shareable platform is the platform that banks will not share. The most intimate platform to the industry is the platform that the banks will keep to themselves. And kid a lot of fintech companies to try and solve problems that they've not been able to solve over time. So the question that I'd like to ask you to have at the back of your head is, as you think about APIs, are you carrying baggage in your head into the future? You know something? We should not even be talking APIs. We've now gone into chatbots. And so those of you who are trying to set up APIs, thinking that that's the future is already here. APIs now function at the back end. And today you need to go looking for that conversation that customers are having to provide your value proposition at the point of need. And that technology is here. It's today. And so, even as we think about what it is that we need to do on the API front, we need to make sense of what is the value, what is the core idea that we want to be able to build, the bridge that we need to build. One of the things that we do in Asian Banker quite well these days is organizing study tours, innovation tours, Silicon Valley, China, the next one in Japan in 2 weeks, and so on. So when we did this in China, the head of wealth management of Ant Financial, which is Alibaba, said that the success of Alipay was not because they thought of a product and they commercialized it. The success of Alipay was because there was a real need in the community on Alibaba's platform. And that came through in the data that they were putting together, or that they were seeing, the trends they were seeing in the data. And similarly, the success of Yebao, that huge mutual fund that they launched, that in 1 year grew to $100 billion, the world's largest and the fastest growing mutual fund that you can ever imagine, all on a mobile device, was because the small merchants that they were doing business with told them that, look, when we need to make payments, there's a float aspect involved. Can we keep the float somewhere in an escrow account, but at the same time, can we invest that? And so they, from all of these needs, they provided solutions. The way banks think about the relationship with customers is the other way around. We think of our products and then work out how to sell it to the customer. And we're not even interested in listening to what the customer really needs. This morning I just took screenshots of one website. I mean, you know, all the banks are equally guilty, so please forgive me for choosing this. But product. When I see products like this on the website, what I see at the back end is a legacy institution made up of thousands of salespeople and a daily sales focus and a fear of not being able to meet targets on a daily basis. I don't see a conversation. I don't see that reaching out to customers to figure out where the need can be. MAS and Association of Banks, very proud of the FinTech Festival. On the morning of after the FinTech Festival, if you took a taxi from the airport to town, there is hardly any taxi driver who will accept credit cards for payments, including the ones who do have credit card machines, despite having a 20% or is it 10% surcharge on credit card payments. They beg you. It's 3 days float. They beg you. I don't have the infrastructure in. They beg you. It's too expensive. MAS and Association Banks slipped in the excuse that real-time payment, peer-to-peer payment, will be out at some point in the future. If you live in condominiums or members of associations like clubs like this, you still need to pay by writing a check. In the newspapers, MAS is so proud that Singapore is up there on the fintech list. At the checkout counter, this looks like a third world country. Cash withdrawal? Proud? Necessary? And if you look at all of the contactless initiatives, the so-called innovations taking place, they're all credit card centric. Because unlike Japan, Malaysia, Australia, and even the US today, this is the one country where there's no legislation on reducing interchange rates so that it promotes the non-interchange based payment infrastructure. But you know what's the saddest thing about this list that can go on of areas where improvements can be made immediately? And it's something that I've mentioned to Jocelyn before. This remains the one country where credit cards are taken away from you by the merchant to a hidden place somewhere, processed and given back to you. Even in China, they don't do that anymore. They bring the device to you. These are small disciplines that can give the man on the street a feel that my country is changing. Because the same man on the street goes to China. I spend every month in China, and I use WeChat. I honestly do not carry cash anymore. And then they come back and they read the newspapers, and there's a disconnect between what the banks are saying about themselves and the experience of the man on the street. And you know what the saddest thing about that disconnect is? There is no complaints. And if you think of complaints as being the first step to building a conversation, the MAS's KPI to banks when they receive complaints is reduce the complaints. This is a country which for 30 years has been trained to leave financial services alone. We don't leave public housing alone. We don't leave healthcare alone. We don't leave transport alone. We complain loudly. But financial services is the one area that has been able to get away with so much. So my last point is this, that if all we've been doing is digging into the world that we've been familiar with, then we're not making a change. At the same time, it's so important to stand away from the hype that we pump ourselves with. We say that the future is in robo-advisors. Robo-advisors is more of the same of a phenomenon that started in the 1970s where retail investors started getting involved in markets. And it's a phenomenon that is changing rapidly because people are no longer investing in companies. Because in companies today, and from the 70s to 80s onwards, to this day, the retained earning capability of the corporate sector has been dwindling. The profitability of the corporate sector has been going down. And what the markets have been doing is instead of investing in underlying assets, they're increasingly investing in indices. And you can tell what the logical conclusion of the robo-advisors will be. It will finally end up in the hands of the investors, and the financial institutions will be disintermediated. One thought that I leave you with is this, and it's someone I respect very much, David Rumsfeld. Nobody hears about him, but he belongs to the RAND Corporation. And in the 1990s, he wrote a paper which said, society moves in four phases: tribal, institutional, markets, and network. And he wrote it at a time when the most advanced equipment you find is the fax machine, and internet was new. When I use this to develop my own thinking of how the financial services industry is moving, I can use it to make sense of things like LIBOR, for example. If you think about LIBOR, it was developed during the tribal phase in the UK, the 17th and 18th century, where market makers got together and shared data with each other. And then it was institutionalized. In 2010, when the LIBOR crisis was breaking up, every time there was an announcement in the UK, the next morning I was always invited to Bloomberg or BBC to make a comment so that they can get an early morning comment, soundbite, and then it travels around the world to the other side. And one question I was always asked was, isn't this fraud on LIBOR going to affect the $5.5 trillion FX market? And I said, LIBOR doesn't owe a duty of care to the FX market. FX belongs to the market's face of human society. At the back of my mind, I knew this. And LIBOR has been institutionalized to provide a guide to loans. It took 7 years before the UK courts were able to prosecute the first person on the grounds of a duty of care to the markets after that. But now we are going on to a whole new world where we're going to be defined by the networks. And the networks do not belong to you or to me. It belongs to the society out there who will be doing things with each other and having intense conversations with each other, to which you, who belong to the institutional phase of human development, will have to figure out a way to plug in and make sense. So if you're carrying your baggage from the banking that you knew into the world that we are going into, you might as well say that there is no sun at night. Thank you.